This podcast is from heptagonclub.co.uk and paulcarenza.com. The Heptagon Club.
Heptagon Club.
Heptagon Club with Paul Carenza. Seven guests, seven corners.
On this week's show,
I saw and talked to Alexis Sale there, but he said,
"I'm in my pajamas. I just, what? I just popped out."
Well, that would be a lovely revelation.
Of course,
yes.
Wouldn't it be lovely?
All right, yeah, Tim Brooke Taylor,
very charming.
And your host,
Mr. Paul Carenza.
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to episode 13. This is Paul Carenza. Episode 13, unlucky for nobody, because right now, the Heptagon Club around me has relocated to Edinburgh, because it's festival time. That's right, I am in Edinburgh, but oddly, only for one day. I leave today, which is the day the Fringe starts, so that's weird. I've seen no shows. I am not doing a show. This August, my festivals are the Camden Fringe on August 26th, 27th, Greenbelt, August 26th, Cornwall Comedy Festival, August 25th. Come and see me at any of those, Cornwall, Kettering or Camden. But no Edinburgh show for me this year. So typically, I've got greater press coverage than I have when I do a show here, including some BBC One primetime profile, because the reason I'm in Edinburgh for one day is I'm doing an interview for Songs of Praise, of all things, on the Edinburgh Fringe. They're doing a little special all about the Edinburgh Fringe, and you can see that on Sunday the 20th of August. So it's fun to be here, even though very briefly. So why not? Indeed, let's do an Edinburgh special. We have enough guests, seven, as is our wont, to do something quite Edinburgh-y. So we've got a bit of Tony Law, the Edinburgh Perrier Award-winning, I think, whatever it's called nowadays, a comedian, Masai Graham, who won the Best Joke of the Fringe Award at last year's Fringe. We've got actors, we've got a playwright who's doing the play A Monk's Tale at the Fringe this year. But headlining, first of all...
Okay, well, I get a bit claustrophobic in pods. I mean, this
was really impressive. Well, we'll open the doors.
The granddaddy of Edinburgh's Free Fringe. This is the guy that set up the model, and he has been gigging for years. He is
Peter Buckley Hill. Yes. Thank you for joining us.
Don't mention it.
Do you like to be thought of as, you know, I was going to say a bona fide, a gold star comedy legend, Jordan, but do you
yes,
want
the
legend
like stage? To be thought of as a bona fide, gold star comedy legend.
That's good, because
I do have an ego, and that would certainly be part of it.
Excellent. Well, embrace that status, absolutely. And it's partly through your performance over the years, performing as a stand-up for as long as there's been a stand-up comedy circuit on the alternative
sort of, yes. I was around in 1980 where the alternative cabaret, as it was then called, scene started at the Earth Exchange in Archway. I mean, the comedy store started around then as well. And that was a slightly different concept.
Yeah.
But yes, I was around then.
So the Archway Club, for example, then what sort of acts were on there then? Was it stand-up? Was it music, comedy?
It was stand-up, it was music, it was poetry, quite a lot of poetry. Mm-hmm. It was pretty much anything.
Yeah.
The whole thing was connected with a cult, which was strange. If you remember Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. I'm sure you do. He used to deliver
absolutely.
Your milk.
He did, no. That's right.
The days when people delivered milk, which they don't anymore.
So a proper cult, because I thought you meant like cult comedy, but it's not cult comedy as in Fist of Fun.
But that as well.
Yeah.
Now famous people played there. Steve Frost and my memory says that I saw and talked to Alexis Sale there, but he says no, he never played it.
Right. So, okay. Yeah. Yes. The Edinburgh shows where you've compared obviously Peter Buckley Hill and some comedians over the years, which I hadn't realised then that is because I thought the free fringe as I knew it was something of relatively more recent years. But actually, that began with that in the 90s.
Yeah, that was the show that started
90s.
It.
Yeah.
And that began in 1996.
Right. So tell us about that. The Free Fringe thing, you look at the Edinburgh Festival, and even before it's the size it now is, even in the late 90s, that it must have been growing at a pace, that you look at it and...
It was pretty huge. Nothing like as huge as it is now, but still pretty huge. I really can't quote any figures, but let's say it was something like 30,000 performances. And I had done shows in the previous 2 years following the conventional model, as you know, one does, obviously, when one doesn't know.
So you'd hire a venue?
You'd hire a venue, sell tickets for something like the going rate.
Yes.
Generally get very low audiences because for this almost the same price they could see someone they'd heard of.
Right, exactly.
I thought I could carry on going for another 20 years doing the same thing.
Yes.
If I could afford the loss, and of course I couldn't afford the loss. I don't know how anybody can.
Yes.
Of course. But I thought it through. What's going to change things? What's going to make it easier? And the obvious answer, to me, the obvious answer anyway, would be not to charge admission.
Yeah.
But to make sure the show was as good, that it was variable, so people could come back again.
Yep.
And would I rather have half a dozen people sitting in the corners at what was then £5 a ticket, income £30 minus
The cost of it all,
the expenses, the cost of it all, minus any rake off that the venue was taking from the tickets. Could I instead have 60 people in who would contribute as little as 50p each? I would have the same money.
Of course, yes, indeed.
If they contributed £1, I would be in profit.
And
in
so this is after
to,
exactly. Course. And after the show, then this is putting the bucket round and all that. Sort of
thing. Yes, that's right. Well, it was a hat in those days, and then someone stole the hat.
Right, I see. The bucket. Yeah. Well, I found you do the bucket thing, and realizing I did a bit less today than yesterday. And I looked at it, and it wasn't because the sun was out or whatever. It was actually the fact that I didn't do as good a show today. And I just found I could chart through it and go, I need to try. And I was making myself try harder each show, knowing that I had to, work harder to get the money that they hadn't yet paid. Whereas in a ticketed show, in advance, people, I think, are a bit more relaxed about it as a performer. So in a way, it makes you work harder, I think.
That's a very interesting point. I've always looked at it from the point of view of the body language.
Right,
In the sense that people have paid, I quoted £5 earlier, because that was the mid-90s, and that was about the normal admission price. Of course, now it's nearer 15 than 5. Mm. But let's say even you've paid £10 for the show.
Yeah.
You are sitting there, and you are now, this is a podcast, so you're really going to see this with your arms.
Of course. We can imagine
and your fault. Whole body language is saying, give me £10 worth of value for this investment that I have made. Whereas the free show, sound effects, uncrosses arms, makes open hand gesture, the audience is open to what you give them.
I did a gig in Morecambe recently. I had my token picture, of course, with Eric Morecambe's statue on the beach. Stayed with a lovely couple who put me up for the night, who told me all about the Edinburgh Harp Festival. Yes, they have a festival for everything, don't they, in Edinburgh? Even the harps. It really is a festival of festivals. So apparently this harp festival is lovely. Apparently harpists are some of the loveliest people in the world, a very generous community. I suppose there's lots of, angelic kind of harping, I suppose, is what they do. And apparently they're very lovely and have a very fine festival also in Edinburgh, because where else would you? So this is our Edinburgh Festival special of the Heptagon Club. Our rule, if you've not heard us here before, we have 7 guests per week. We've already had Peter Buckley-Hill. He will be back, but intermingling with our other guests as well. So indeed, back to the comedy side of the Fringe. We have got, right now, the punsmith behind the very best joke of the Fringe last year. Apparently, it has been decided there is an award. Therefore, it is objectively the funniest joke on the Fringe. So this guy is Masai Graham. His joke, incidentally, should you wish to know, was simply this. Here we are. My dad suggested I register for a donor card. He's a man after my own heart. Well, he says it better.
Masai Graham. Or to give you your full name?
Masai Martin Marcus Sherlock Graham.
Yeah, that's at the tip of my tongue, that was.
Yeah, it was awesome.
You are the one-liner king.
It is, well, literally, you won the award last year at Edinburgh, didn't you? Best joke of the Fringe.
Oh yeah, I won Best Joke of the Fringe, 2016. And then February, 6 months before that, I won UK Pun Champion. So yes. Yeah, it was a great year last year. So yeah. I just enjoy writing jokes. But...
And it's nice because you veer between the, as you note yourself on stage, like clean, naughty, which way are we going?
Okay. Exactly, yeah. So like I said, growing up, my hero was Tim Vine, and he was the reason I got into it. And he's so prolific of just doing clean jokes. But then I also like comics like Gary Dedoni and Anthony Jeselnik and Stuart Francis, who also do more edgy jokes. Yeah. But yeah, it's just great writing jokes, and you'll transfer out the crowd to see what they prefer. Yeah. And it'll be nice to get developed where I can have 20 minutes of clean or naughty, solid material that I'm happy with, and then whatever audience I'm faced with.
Yeah, you can choose.
I can choose.
Book A or Book B, isn't it? It's like, was it, I forget, who was it? Max Miller, who had the. Who gave us the word blue?
Yes.
Because he had the blue book or the red book. Yeah. People could choose. They chose blue book, it was the naughty ones. And that's why we got blue comedy today. That's
there you go.
From. There you go. Bit of history.
He was great there. He'd do that little hand whisper gesture to say, oh, bit of blue.
Bit of cheeky, cheeky stuff.
No,
we're still using that, aren't we?
One of my best ever sitcoms is Not Going Out. So that intertwined with the time when I first started, 2010, when I first started doing stand up. Tim Vine fan, and then when I watched that, because I saw a sitcom writing enthusiast, he was like, man, someone's managed to squeeze one-liners into a sitcom, and it works.
Well, Lee's thing with that was always, you know, people used to say, apparently, at the time, the industry standard was like 3 laughs per page, which you know, and it's like, why have 3? That's like 1 every 20 seconds. It's 19 seconds of nothing, and then a laugh, so let's have 8, you know, let's... Yeah. And we've had these meetings where we go like, this mic, we need to make this line funny. You go, Lee, that's the setup. You need that for the punchline. We need that to be funny
it's
as well.
It's like joke of, I always thought my nan would live to 100, really close, she was 96. One of my favourites ever.
The Heptagon Club.
7 guests, 7 corners. The Heptagon Club with Paul Forenza.
Someone on telly, I forget who it is, it's just... as well, I have forgotten, is graciously doing a fringe show but charging £19.50 a ticket.
Oh, yes, indeed, yes.
Someone even more famous than that charged £35 a ticket a few years ago. That's not a fringe, in my opinion.
Yes, this is the thing, it's the difference between the festival and, you know, we do have the International Festival, of course, which is all very,
very
polloi and ballet dances and that sort of thing.
The International Festival. Absolutely.
But then,
I'm there with my flat saying, International Festival.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Come on, you aren't.
Can it be a fringe if it's a sitcom star playing the castle to several thousand seats and we all notice our ticket numbers going down that night? You know, it's, I do recall that from a few years ago and it was rather a slow one, you know, but.
I'm trying not to isolate that down to an individual.
Sure, but it's
I know that individual. I like that individual.
Yeah, it's more an industry trend, isn't it, rather than
exactly. It was probably not his decision at all.
No. And in their shoes, you can see why. There are thousands of comedy goers in one place. Let's turn up and do a show for them.
Absolutely. Yes.
Look at the comedy circuit nowadays, and I like the days when it was good level to me when Time Out had all the listings and that sort of thing.
Oh yeah, no, I missed that.
You know, that was always nice
because the online listings don't even work. I can't get them.
There's no real way now of telling exactly what clubs are out there and what comedians are out there. And all the comedians had an adjective, which was quite nice. I used to like that.
Well,
do you remember what your adjective was?
Well, it took me some time to get it.
It took you a while to get it.
I remember the wonderful week in which, for one listing, I was described as newish, and a second listing the same week described me as experienced. Nice one, yes.
That's
so
right,
newish
in the level.
And experienced.
Right in the balance. Newish experience.
Love it. I don't think I can claim newish anymore.
Well, experienced is newish, isn't it? In a way, I suppose.
I'm trying to remember what my final adjective was. I think it was eccentric.
That's fine to go with that. That's all right. Am I right in thinking as a day job, as well, you are still...
I do care work.
Care work, that's right, yeah. I was thinking, I knew it was something good, and you know, this kind of this rather flippant you know, evening work.
Well, I'm 30.
Is accompanied by that, isn't it?
I'm nearly 37, and I started doing care work when I was 16.
Yeah.
So that's nearly 20 years. So it's, I always enjoy doing care work, and I've got disabled family members as well. So I'll always do care work, and this is my hobby. Yeah. So as far as I get with it, I'll get with it. But you know, I don't crave for the spotlight or to get to the top. I just enjoy writing jokes, gigging when I can, and doing my job. There's nothing better than doing my care work in the day, knowing that I get to go somewhere to do a gig later that night.
And so do you find as well, I know my wife's medical and her family are, and I know that, you know, you have that sense of people in the medical sort of trade maybe have that slightly, dare I say, gallows humour. That,
yes.
Because some of your jokes go to places that I haven't heard many comedians go.
Yeah, they're quite dark, but it's always based around either a pun, one line, a wordplay, or pull back and reveal. So I don't sit down and think, right, let me write something evil.
Yeah.
It's, something will catch my brain, and then a joke will form that, and it will either fall into the clean or naughty category. Yeah, it is 9:30, so in 12 hours I'll be back at my care job.
Good on you, man. Yeah, good on you.
Crazy.
Good on you.
Man.
Days caring and nights.
Yeah, well, it's just a happy balance, man. Caring in the day, making people laugh, hopefully, in the evening.
It's the squeezed middle, as always, because, I mean, the circuit is drying up a bit at the top.
Yes.
Obviously, with much less jongleurs' work than there used to be.
Yeah.
And therefore, acts who were playing that sort of circuit are now playing much more frequently smaller clubs for less money.
It trickles down, doesn't it?
It trickles down, indeed, which cuts off the opportunities for relatively inexperienced acts. So, I mean, there always was a huge wastage rate, but now I think the wastage rate is phenomenal. And the clear progression path that they used to be when I started, open spot to unpaid 10 to paid 10 to paid 20. It was a clear pathway.
So we've had Masai Graham, Peter Buckley Hill, bits of them maybe later as we go along. Other people in Edinburgh, other friends of the show. Eric McElroy, he's been on the show before. He's up there the whole month doing a show. Matt Green is up there doing a show. Martin Huburn, I hope I pronounced your name vaguely correctly. I mean, Martin, very difficult name to say. He's doing a show 12th to the 27th, 3:45 p.m. You can catch that. Martin's show is all about discrimination and banter. I don't know if it's about banter. It probably contains banter about discrimination. But that's on at the Laughing Horse at 48 Below. But meanwhile, another guest who has been on the podcast a couple of times, actually, James Carey. He is a writer of TV sitcoms like Miranda and Bluestone 4-2. And delightfully now, he's brought us a Monk's Tale for the stage. Catch it at the Edinburgh Festival this summer or on tour later in the autumn. Oh, while we're plugging, of course, don't forget I'm at the Camden Fringe this August. And with Navelous Gazing, that's my current solo show I'm touring around. Also, it's at the Museum of Comedy, September 23rd. And then it's at the Liverpool and Nottingham festivals for that show. I'm generally gigging around as well. Also, if you've got a venue, you can book me. I am available. I do have my solo show of two halves that tours around churches. I do at least normally about one show a week doing those shows around churches. So that's always nice. The comedy circuit as well at large. Always happy to do bits and pieces there. So if you are listening and have an inroad into either of those, I am very bookable. Meanwhile, anyway, enough plugging. Let's have James Carey. And also following that, we'll also hear a little bit from some of his cast.
So sitcom clearly is something you've been... Were you always working towards it? Because when you... I presume you were doing... Did you do sketch shows and things?
I used to do sketches at university, particularly in your... When you're in your teens and early 20s, you have tons of ideas, but you don't really understand people very well. So that's why it sort of... That's why young people, when they ask me advice... Say young people, I'm 41, so I'm not young, but at least I'm not old. But when people in their 20s do say, I want to write a sitcom, what should I do? My advice, slightly unhelpfully, is usually be older.
Right.
Because I think to write a sitcom well, you have to have multiple perspectives on things. You have to be able to write characters that are speaking their truth from all these different angles, and you have to have probably more empathy than your average, usually chronically over-educated, early 20-something male. You know, there are women writing sitcoms, but the people who ask me are normally men. There may be other reasons for that. I don't know. Let's not go into that.
Yeah.
But I like writing sitcom, and the reason that I only worked this out recently, actually, it was only in the last few months, so it's great that you're here.
Good, I'm happy to have unlocked this. Yeah.
Is the reason that I shall credit you with it. I wondered why I'm actually a writer, and I think I'm a writer because actually I love comedy.
Right.
So some writers are writers because they love writing. Mm. I'm a writer because I love comedy, and if it's not funny, I don't really see the point.
So do you think can you ever see yourself writing a drama series?
Well,
because you do get some comedy writers going into that, aren't they?
If anyone from BBC One writing me is listening, I would very much be interested in writing a drama series.
Yes.
I think it would be comedy drama.
Yeah.
But the reason, as I say, the reason I got into writing comedy in my teens is because I love comedy and I wanted to know how it worked.
Mm.
And if you want to know how it works and you're not particularly a performer, going back to how we started, is you're sort of, you know, you're lifting up the bonnet, you're putting your head in there and just sort of working out how all these bits fit together, what are they and how do I do it for myself, you know, or for other people. So that's kind of what got me into it. And so that's why I like writing comedy, because to me, when an audience laughs, because I always much prefer studio comedy to non-audience comedy, which is a shame that my TV sitcom was a non-audience show, but you can't really detonate bombs in a studio.
It would have been tricky.
They don't like that.
Yes.
They don't like that. But that's why I really enjoyed all the radio stuff that I've done, is because I usually sit in the audience, they don't know I'm the writer, and I can just hear people laughing, and I'm thinking, if they laugh at a joke that I liked, I think, oh, they like that one, tick, I was right about that.
Mm.
Oh, they like that one. Oh, they didn't like that one. I wonder why that was. Oh, they like that one. Oh, they really like that joke. I didn't quite know. So for me, it's problem solving.
Yeah.
That's how unempathetic I am, really, isn't it? Am I right?
Well, okay, that then springs into various questions from that. So one is, do you find, as I do, that there is a difficulty, you're writing a sitcom script, or in like a stand-up, or whatever it might be, any sort of comedy, and you think, that's funny. But do you never quite know until the audience get hold of it? And does that surprise you sometimes?
Yeah, no, the audiences are frequently full of surprises. So I think when you're starting out, you might have, you know, you're writing all these jokes in a sketch or a sitcom script, and maybe 30% of them work really well, 10% go fine, and the rest don't really work. As you get more experience, you start to get closer to 50, 60, 65%. And thereafter, you're sort of into legend territory.
Yes.
So I think, you know, you don't really expect everything to get a laugh, and you just hope that the bits that do get, that don't get laughs, you're able to cut. It's annoying if you can't cut a bit because it's crucial for the plot or something. I think when you're starting out writing, you do think, you do cling on to your jokes quite hard.
Yes.
And that's why writers tend to not make particularly good stand-ups, because writers sort of rewrite jokes quite quickly, whereas stand-ups who tend to try to, okay, that didn't work, how do I make it work?
Yes. Yes.
And someone who is a writer in their bones would just say, I'll just write a new joke.
Yes. Well, yes, we will hear from a stand-up in a moment. Tony Law will be gracing us with his presence. But that was James. And so the cast of his play, A Monk's Tale, as Anna Nicholson, Anna Newcombe and Cameron Potts. They are over in this corner of our seven-sided pod venue. And here are their voices.
How's the show going? Are you doing a show about the Reformation? What have you learned about the Reformation?
Well,
doing a show?
What we learned?
Knowledge
it was
can
a bit of a blank
with?
Slate before.
Right,
okay. Everything. So, I do like to try and research the topic of the show before the show starts. I'm still learning. I'm still.
So it's your job to bring this to life.
Every day,
we're doing a three-person sketch show.
Excellent.
About Martin Luther and his impact upon the Roman Catholic Church, which then split into various factions.
Brilliant. So it's the door and the nailing of things.
Yes, the 95 Theses to the Door. Yep. The show is called A Monk's Tale, Relics, Revolt and Reformation. It's written by James Carey.
Yes.
Who
is here somewhere in the Heptagon Club, appearing as a guest.
Oh, there he is.
Oh, hey, James.
Hello, James.
Hey, James.
Hi, James.
He's talking about your show.
Sketches, songs. I wear a lot of hats.
Right.
I'm the only one that wears headgear, actually. Don't know why that is.
I want to disagree with you on that.
Oh, I totally disagree.
We all wear headgear.
One point.
We all wear a cowboy hat.
That's true.
To be the English reformers.
So yeah, we've got a song about the a bunch of blokes. martyrs, you might call them right. nowadays, who translated the Bible into English when it was illegal, and we made it into a sort of Western.
Nice.
Like the outlaws.
Ah, yeah, okay. Because they were being roguish and outlawish.
Being so roguish with their yes. Bible translation skills. Yes. So
we also have some original songs.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Mm-hmm. By James Sherwood.
Ah, yes.
Another fine composer of comedy song.
Yes, he's yet to guest on this podcast, but we will get him at some point.
Well, make sure he brings his piano.
He's good, yes. James Sherwood at the piano.
Indeed.
We've got a rap in there, because everyone loves a rap. it's a crowd favourite. Yeah, yeah. I've learnt what relics are. I didn't even know what a relic was.
Wait, there's a whole song about relics.
So they're bits of old people.
Bits of dead people that seem significant.
Bits of saints.
Bits of saints. If you touch them, it takes your time off purgatory.
If all of the relics added up, you know, you can't have like five kidneys of John the Baptist or...
That's it,
you
exactly.
know, 29 toenails. You could have a lot of toenails, actually, but toes you couldn't have.
You would hit the nail on the head.
That's exactly
hit the nail on the door.
That is the point of the song.
Ah, very good. So I don't want to second guess the song here.
Wow.
Yes.
But it's fun, and it's fun for people that know a lot about the Reformation and also people that know nothing about
it. Excellent.
Yeah.
So,
indeed. Yeah, we've had good reviews from historians and children.
That's the two target audiences you need. Yeah. You get those two, you're set.
Yeah.
You're set. Oh, well, happy touring. Excellent news.
We'll
this
be
is good.
Fully sick of each other.
I'm sure. I'm
which
sure.
is which is hilarious because two of us went to school together.
Yeah. And which two? Guest listener.
And indeed.
Or maybe we'll just tell you.
Yes.
It's the bloke and the blonde.
Oh, okay. Which you can't tell who the blonde is from
there. No, but you can tell who the bloke is.
You can definitely tell.
You can probably tell who the blonde is, to be honest.
Well, you said it.
Occasionally you get those where you just turn up and go, the audience aren't quite going. What's. Sometimes you do have to blame the audience. Oh, they're not quite going for this.
We had one of those on Milton Jones.
Right.
Where we... Milton Jones, Formula One racing driver. Mm. This was the... what was it? Another case of Milton Jones, I think. One of the many incarnations.
Yes, yeah.
And that was after the House of Milton Jones.
Right.
Which is also after the very world of Milton Jones. The producer came out, David Tyler came out and sort of does a very nice warm-up normally gets very decent, polite laughs, and then he introduces Milton and then, you know. But he came out, David Tyler came out, did some jokes, and audience went, not really going to get
it. Not going for it.
Not going for it.
Okay.
And then he introduced Milton, and Milton comes to the front, and Milton did some jokes. They didn't really go for those either.
Really?
To which you think... Why are you here?
Yeah.
Why did you come to see...
Fair enough if you're not a David Tyler fan.
Yes.
If you're not a Milton Jones fan.
Yes, that's
really.
Right. People, they don't book for David Tyler.
Yeah, he's a lovely fella.
He's a lovely fella, but...
He's not the reason you turn up.
No, absolutely not. It doesn't sound too bad when you hear it go out. And if you... I haven't heard it so recently to think, knowing it's a bad audience, do you hear that? Mm. But no, David Tyler, the master of the edit, has made it sound gorgeous and wonderful.
Well, of course. I remember I was working on a sitcom years ago when I obviously think I was one of the writing team and I'm thinking, I'm adding the jokes to this. This is great. And then a friend of mine from university, it turns out, was doing the sound editing on that show by pure chance. And so I bumped into him a few months later. He said, oh, I'm working on this show. I said, I was working on that show. And he said, oh, yeah, I've been adding the laughs to it. I was thinking, that's what I've been doing. But, of course, no, he's been adding the actual laughs. And some of the jokes that we were doing weren't quite landing in the same way. And he may have been peppering them up a little bit. Who knows? But not for me to say.
I'm always interested. We're now onto canned laughter.
We are, yeah. It's a matter of time.
It's always a matter of time. But the... I always say that they don't cheat laughs, which I suspect is not strictly true, and your evidence would suggest that it isn't. Because normally they actually, if anything, take away laughs.
Yeah, I believe they often tone it down because people laugh too much.
Yeah, and it's quite annoying at home if you're listening to an audience. I find that with I'm Sorry I Haven't the Clue, which sounds more like a Nuremberg rally now.
Yes, it can do.
It's just like, now it's about time for Mornington Crescent.
Yes.
Absolutely huge. Wow, this is how revolutions start. Although it would be a lovely revolution.
Of course, wouldn't it be lovely?
That's right, yeah. Tim Brooke Taylor.
Very charming.
Yes. The only times that I've sort of hand on heart said I'm happy to cheat a laugh is when I used to write episodes of My Hero with Ardal O'Hanlon as superhero. And there are one or two jokes where you couldn't cut them because the audience, it just wouldn't make any sense without them.
Yeah.
But there not being a laugh on that line sounds weird.
Yes. Yeah.
And so on that occasion, I don't have an ethical problem with sticking a laugh in purely for the sake of it not sounding weird. The only other time I've done it myself, though, I did a DVD of a play I wrote called The God Particle.
Mm.
And there is a line in it, and something that the guy, one of the cast does, that gets a laugh every single time without fail.
Right.
Except for the one time we shot it on DVD in front of an audience, and it got nothing.
With fail on that occasion.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah. And literally, I've never seen it not get a laugh.
Yeah.
And so I cheated it and stuck one on there.
That's fair enough.
Because,
that's fair enough.
You know, we could have got away without putting one there.
Yeah.
I think
most of the ones that I was thinking about are not so much when there's no laugh, but it's often the laugh's weird, or it's like there's an odd guffaw or a little titter, and it should be a hearty laugh.
Yeah, and it just gets in the way.
And they got some sort of weird audience response, which is half laugh, half snort, half whatever it might be.
Yeah,
so
it only takes one person in an audience.
It does.
To make a weird sound, and it does make quite a profound difference.
Right, well, it's time for a stand-up and a fringe favourite, an Edinburgh Comedy Award-winning Canadian. So next episode of this podcast will be his episode, headlining, featuring, starring Mr. Tony Law. But here is just a wee dram. It's from our live show. He was in his actual pyjamas. So there you go. He lived nearby, so it's quite handy. It's a very special performance, but unfortunately it was running about an hour late due to reasons outside of our control. So once again, further apologies to anyone who came to the live show, whether to perform or to watch. It was a bit of a shambles, but fun all the same. And will we do it again? Well, probably not, but who knows? Well, maybe. Well, either way, here for a little bit for this week is Tony Law.
I'm in my pajamas. I just popped out. I was doing a little reading.
Nice.
Not a great reader, but the kids don't know any better.
Okay,
because they're young. I just wanted to see you. Well, I haven't seen you for so long.
It's funny to see you.
That's true.
I heard as well a lot about the fact that Tony Law changes his look all the time, and now it's the pajama season. This is what it's all about. This is the
new look. So this is my reading attire.
And what are you reading? What's in your
Diary of a Wimpy Kid?
Okay.
It's not that good. 8-year-olds dig it, but I don't like it. I prefer Roald Dahl. That's hard to read that good.
Yeah, it is. You know what? I was really
my vocabulary. Hard to read that good, eh?
I was really expecting that.
I get more Canadian when I'm on a microphone because I forget how we talk until I hear it. So now I've adopted slow farmers. If anybody wanted to know what a farmer from Canada talked like,
it's pretty good, yeah. So you can be racist in a gentle voice like that and just nod and go, well, like that. And you don't even notice it's happening until it's too late, and then you feel sick that you didn't say something.
So on this podcast, it is polite to bring a bottle, isn't it? To all parties, really. This party, for the years, is no exception. Our regular request for one small bit of giving back on your part. So this time, my request to you, dear listener, favourite listener, you are my favourite. Yes, you. If you pre-order my book. Now, I know it sounds a bit pluggy, but bear with, okay? You know, we do have donate buttons on the heptagonclub.co.uk page. We also have a Patreon button at the top, which all podcasts generally seem to do if you would like to donate regularly. No one knows if anyone has ever clicked a Patreon button, but apparently these things do happen. And then you get rewarded by giving regularly with unique goodies and treats and experiences and things like that. Or there is the one-off donate button. But I know full well that the thing with podcast payment requests is, why do it? It's free already. You know, I've listened, it was great, but financial contributions, I don't think so. Tricky to motivate yourself. So what I would like this week, you'll bring a bottle moment, give something back. If you would like to donate, it's there. But to actually give and get something in return, you can pre-order my book, right? I've got three new books on the way soon, actually. But the first and main one I pitch to you right now is Hark, The Biography of Christmas. Okay, I've spent a couple of years researching, writing, honing, telling the story of every part of the modern Christmas, from Norse Yule and Nativity to Noddy Holder and the weird Japanese custom of eating KFC on Christmas Day. That is just one of their things they do. So I'm telling in this book that via the 12 dates of Christmas, you can see what I've done there, tracing the 12 historical moments when I feel that Christmas became a little bit more like Christmas. So it's all, you know, Scrooge and crackers and turkey and mince pies and things. It's illustrated and it's fun and it's enlightening, and it will be, I think, brilliant. It's out end of September, and I will be probably trailing some more stuff on the podcast over Christmas along those lines. I'm trying to get something going for TV and radio as well. Watch this space. We will see if we can get some Christmas history on the TV and on the radio if we can. So, festive history. It's yours to pre-order. Hark, The Biography of Christmas. It's on Amazon and Waterstones and all these other things. I know it's early to think of Christmas, but that's why you pre-order now, and it will arrive nearer at the time. It's only $7.99. Don't be fooled by what you may see online. Amazon may quote it higher because we're going to do a hardback, and now we're just doing a paperback, so the price will drop if they've not updated it already. So, I've also got a couple of kids' books out next February, so you can always find those online. Noah's Car Park Ark and Moses and the Exodus Express. You know, kids' Bible rhyming, beautifully illustrated books as well. So pre-order that if you like. But the Christmas one, that is the first one out. That would be amazing. You'll bring a bottle moment. If you would like to give something back, is to buy a book, basically. And it's only £8, maybe even less on Amazon. I don't know. But I shouldn't. Other websites are available who do pay their taxes. So do support the little people. Get online. The links are on our Facebook page. You can pre-order the book. Tell me that you've done it. I would love to know. Thank you. And you could pause now, in fact, and do that right now. And then listen to our amazing guests. Good. So back to our guests. Our Free Fringe founder, Peter Buckley Hill. He is our star guest of the week. Speaking of collection buckets, which is basically what I'm doing right now and asking you to buy my book, let's go back to Peter.
Remembering my second ever Free Fringe show, put the bucket out, and I found out afterwards when I checked through it that one of the chinks was not a coin going in, but car key, but house keys. Actual house keys, which I still have, because of course I had no way of tracing whose they were.
No, and, absolutely.
I'd like to think someone has given me a contact, house, but I can't access it. So,
well, they could have wanted to call down.
I think it was the biggest gift I'd ever had.
All sorts of dirty Edinburgh things.
You'd never know.
You'd never know.
I think actually I returned it to the bar. I think, and so here's hoping they didn't want to give me a house.
They would at least have a tax and address.
It would have been nice to say this is yours from now on, but anyway. Any parting messages of wisdom that before we
always, always carry a pair of pants with you.
Oh yeah,
at all times.
We were talking about this.
And a toothbrush.
Pants should be straight away to get end up.
Yes. So carry as in not just wear, but actually
carry in your person.
Yes.
New person.
I just think it's just always good, isn't it? If you find yourself out and about, you're at a dinner party, you missed the last tube.
Helpful advice from Nick's.
I worked on a.
Sorry.
Yeah, there was a TV show last year, and I was in the production office a lot, where they kept on having to do overseas trips and things, and they would always get off the phone going, better go and buy another pair of pants then, which generally meant that they would have to go on a plane that day, pretty much, and not have time to go home.
So,
you know, this is it. You've got to have them with you. You never know. I mean, most of us don't work in such high-flying jobs.
Indeed not. Although, if I was to be on a panto tour, and they were to say, you need to buy something in underwear,
yes,
I'd probably stop the job. I would say, do work that you find creatively stimulating and you enjoy.
Ooh.
With people you like.
Nice.
Because otherwise you are going to be bored and unhappy.
And one day you may get to do that.
Well, indeed, quite right. Yes. One day.
That's very good.
Oh, gosh, that's rubbish. I say something about pants and you say that.
Well, you've got to redeem yourself somehow.
Is there a sitcom that is the best of all time?
My favourite sitcom of all time is Yes, Prime Minister. My favourite American sitcom of all time is Seinfeld. Mm. I admire Friends and Frasier, but if I had to choose, I would pick Seinfeld. Mm. And I also find it very hard to turn off old episodes of Porridge.
Right.
And I have, those are probably some of my favourites.
Yeah, yeah. That's good.
A respectable list.
Good choices.
I could find really obscure stuff to make me sound clever.
That's fine. But that's, I think, well, even things like Porridge nowadays is, well, of course, it's got maybe a Porridge Renaissance. Who knows?
Well, it's going to be, it's been recommissioned. There's going to be a new.
There's new Porridge.
Yeah. New Porridge.
I was asked that question a few years ago, and I was there thinking, I always think either Blackadder or Fawlty Towers. I don't know which one. Ooh, I'm going to say Blackadder on this occasion. And a voice behind me said, good choice. And I turned around, it was Richard Curtis, who happened to be at the same venue. So, look around before you answer these questions.
Right, I will do.
Tony Law, of all people.
Hello.
I was
in his jammies.
In his jammies.
Don't sleep in these, though. Yeah, I just come out to do your show, and then they'll be off.
When I said what you're reading, I thought you were going to go into the Silk...
The Silk Road.
Because I know you're a big reader of the big
books. Well, when the email came through, that's what I was reading about.
And then now it's Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
Yeah, I just wanted to say Silk Road. I like it.
Yeah, so next time, Tony Law on the Silk Road. That was the Silk Road was the book he was talking about there that he's been reading, not the Silk Robe, which he could have been sporting with his pyjama wear. So, yeah, next episode will be after a little bit of a summer break. So it'll be more like in mid-September, maybe even late September. I don't know. But we'll have a good 4 to 6 weeks off probably for our summer break. So, you know, you may be off to Edinburgh on holiday. You may be coming to my Camden Fringe show. Who can say? But in about a month and a bit's time, Tony Law will feature on this podcast. Becca Barron, the storyteller, will feature also on our live show. She was also on our live show as our podcast favourite, QI's Stephen Colgan, who was fantastic. So we are saving all those up for our next episode, episode 14. They are awesome. Do stay tuned for them. So we should be wrapping up for this week. Final farewells then from PBH, Peter Buckley Hill, on what is next for him.
I'm recording all the songs that I have not yet recorded.
Okay.
And that particular show is intended to be my Abbey Road.
Right. Oh, really?
But it will probably end up being my Let It Be.
Okay. And, well, either way, I'd take either. I'd take either. That would be all right, wouldn't it?
The second is the one-man show I did in Edinburgh.
Okay.
Last year. Right. Not many people came to, which I hope was largely because I wasn't on the street leafleting for it. I thought this was because I was old and tired, but it turns out that I was very ill and didn't know it, so that's why I wasn't publicising it or indeed performing it particularly well.
Yes.
But I still have a certain amount of faith in the show, and it's an hour show delivered entirely in haikus.
Right.
Yes.
An hour of haikus.
An hour of haikus.
Wow.
Now, by the time your listeners...
Yes.
You have listeners. By the time your listeners hear this... this will probably have happened, and it will be on its way to being on the web for free download.
Right.
Exactly so how, I don't know.
Okay.
Because, you know, I don't understand these things. Presumably YouTube will come into it, and my other albums are on the web. I don't know how they got there. Someone else did it for me. I'll just have to find that one person and... ask him
make it happen
to make it happen again. Yeah, both shows will
be online. Both shows, brilliant. Yeah,
In I hope audio and video.
Excellent. So in lieu of a time machine, we can't make the gig, but we can download accordingly. So well, thanks for speaking to us, and thank you for, you know, the Free Fringe is an amazing model, and it's great that transforming the festival before our very eyes. But either way, the pod will open shortly, and you'll be released back into society, and take a breath of fresh air.
It's just like being born, isn't it?
I like to think so. Yeah. I like to think there's a very similarity between this podcast and being born. Absolutely.
Well, the pod door is released. The club is closed. Our summer break awaits. So I do wish you a great summer. Go and see some live shows if you possibly can, to festivals, whatever you may be at. I've told you all about mine. So Camden, Kettering and Cornwall. And I'm in Bath a bit as well. And I'm in Chester. And I'm doing a London writey thing and all sorts of things. So that would be fantastic. Pre-order my book, if you would. That would be amazing. It's online. Tell me you've done it, by all means. If everyone who listens pre-orders the book, and indeed all my Facebook friends were to as well, it would be a bestseller automatically. Just think of that. So anyway, thank you to you for listening, to all of our guests for this week, for Rob Halligan for providing the music. My gigs are on paulcarenza.com. I'm on Twitter. Find the Heptagon Club podcast page on Facebook. Give that a like. You could donate or Patreon on heptagonclub.co.uk. Oh, and tune into Songs of Praise. It doesn't matter what you wear. On August the 20th, you might see a familiar voice face. Till episode 14 lands in September, I bid you a very merry summer.